accession number 20311, reel 3.
Yes, he was liaising with the infantry, and we had a sergeant who, well, I think he'd got his tapes by yes, sir, no, sir, three bags full, sir, and we knew he wasn't very efficient. He was the actual gunner in the tank, but technically, yeah, I don't think he knew anything about warfare, and no way was he going to take over the tank. He came from Southampton, Sergeant Reeves, and Turnbull, the wireless operator, another Yorkshireman, who we had a great rapport with each other, the two of us, the driver. And we'd been following the battle through the intercom. My co-driver and front gunner was Fred Nibbs. He came from the Bishop Auckland area, very conscientious, good living bloke. We thought, oh, we're going to get in a sticky position if we take notice of this Sergeant Reeves. So Bill Turnbull, who was the wireless operator, very efficient, he said, don't take no notice of him, Bill. He said, we'll most probably get shot up. So he said, you turn the other way opposite him, and which I did. And we always say that we saved one another's lives by it, because I'm certain we should have got shot up with a Tiger or a Panther tank. And we must probably have been cremated there and then. And to this day, whenever I've seen Bill, he's dead and gone now, lives down at Tiverton, he always brought that incident up, like, you know. And he said we saved one another's lives. And I think he did. I don't know what happened to Sergeant Reeves, whether the word got to the senior officers and he got sent somewhere else, but we lost him, you know. So, you know, I know all's fair in love and war, but you don't always have confidence in the senior ranks. I remember after that first night, we had to dig in, and it was hard going. We used to dig a trench, the width and length of the tank, and if we knew it was solid ground, I used to reverse the tank, spanning this trench, and we could get a bit of sleep, foot to foot, you know, one in each corner, one head in each corner. And I'm a pretty sound sleeper. I mentioned to you when I first met you this morning, I have a short session of death for a few hours. And I roused up the next morning, and I heard all this shell fire. And I looked round, and I thought, where's the other three members? Have they left me, because I'm the best looking, and took the other three prisoner? But then I heard through the intercom that our tank had to move. Move? Here I am, laid here. How am I going to get out all the shell fire? Well, we had a pannier door at the side of the tank, so I jumped out, dived in head first, and the tank should have been warmed up for about a quarter of an hour. You weren't supposed to move because you had to have the engine warm before the 40-ton gun. Anyway, I took a chance. All the personal weapons were laid there. They'd got in the tank and left their personal weapons, which was a crime. I think I managed to pick mine. I had Sten guns. I didn't have a revolver. And they were left, and I thought, what's going to happen if they've lost all the, you know. But luckily, after about 2 hours, we happened to come back by the same, area, and one of them, the shell fire had ceased, and one of them dived out of the tank and picked their personal weapons and the odd blanket up. That was my first experience of battle, the first 24 hours.
Was it frightening?
Yeah, it's certainly frightening. But, you know, after the initial, I suppose, you don't know what's going to happen the first time, but after it's happened, you, I suppose you get a bit more confidence. You've survived the first, you know, first blasting. But after that, you just went in with more confidence, and you used to think, oh, well, it's not going to happen to me, you know. I've got a good bloke up there looking after me.
Which troop or squadron were you in?
I was in number one squadron, 4th Battalion. I was in the headquarter troop, which carried the command, the squadron commander, and those officers on every tank were on the other troops. You just had one officer as a troop commander, and the other tanks were commanded by full sergeants.
What happened next?
Well, as I say, we had this 3 weeks. We did have the odd quiet day, you know, but, you know, all around Tinchbury and Winnington. I just can't memorise all the little places. Villiers Bockage. It was bad tank country, because you had steep banks, and the lanes were that narrow before you got to the bank at the other side, and you bellied down before you got to the point of balance, and the front of the tank had got into the lane. You didn't have no grip to climb the bank at the other side, so you're sort of looking for a place where you're not going to get bogged down. I mean, some people maybe like to get bogged down. Well, not bogged down, but stuck fast. The tracks wouldn't grip, you see. They were revolving, and there was nothing to grip, you know, because you'd gone down the steep bank, and you couldn't get back up the other side. It wasn't very good tank country in that part of Normandy. But we survived, and we didn't miss an action, you know. I just can't remember every detail now, but as I say, we had the 3 weeks, and there was quite a few casualties. One instance was Major Hambrough, my squadron and troop commander. He got wounded on August the 12th, the glorious 12th, I always remember that. And so my tank commander, Captain Tennant, squadron commander. So I lost Major Tennant, who I'd had a good relationship with from starting training with the tanks right through the campaign. And so this is where I got Captain Christopher Schofield, who became my tank commander from just after the 12th of August till he was made adjutant of the battalion, which was after the Operation Market Garden, when the paratroopers failed to get the bridge at Arnhem. Then I had other tank commanders, and there was casualties, and on one occasion I didn't have an officer. We were just managed with a sergeant, tank commander, till we got Mr. Robb, and Mr. Robb came as a young officer, and I didn't know Mr. Robb. He came as a young officer, a replacement. He was put on my tank, and he hadn't been on it for about an hour. He had his head out the cupola, shell burst on the adjoining tank, took part of his cheek away. Ferried him back to a field ambulance station, where we left him, and he was told he had to go back further. And so we were hauled down for the whole day, brewing up. We were told to stay where we were. There was no movement, somewhere around Moyland in Germany. I never met Mr. Robb from that day till I went to a 50th reunion 10 years ago. Mr. Robb was there, and so we had a good reunion. He didn't even know who was driving the tank when he got his wound, because he'd just come up from England as a replacement.
Was it necessary for him to have stuck his head out of the cupola?
Well, I mean, I said he hadn't had much training when I've met him since, and he said he hadn't had a lot. I don't think it was necessary, you know, whether he was inexperienced or he didn't realise what the opposition was at the time, you know. But I met Mr. Robert at the 53rd anniversary dinner of the formation of the battalion, and he lives in London actually, and I got an advance. I happened to be in London, I got an advance list of who was going to be there, and I saw Mr. J.M. Robb, and I went to him at the reception and said, "Are you Mr. Robb?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Can you remember who was driving that tank when you got your facial injury?" He said, "No, I can't." He said, "I didn't know any of you." I said, "Oh, well, I'm the driver, Well, he said, "I'm pleased to see you." And he said, "You must come and sit with us at the table." So there was tables for 10. There was 5 officers and 5 other ranks. And it was just as though we were all other ranks. There was no snobbishness or anything, you know. It was great. And he actually sent me a book of the history of the 5th Guards Tank Brigade, because I wasn't able to get one as I was released early, you know, from the regiment.
What did you think of the Germans you were fighting in Normandy?
The Germans? Yes, I often speak to my wife about the German nation. I think it's beginning to prove it all these years after. I mean, the recent problem with East Dagenham, that they were a hard-working nation. They didn't have any string to tie the corn up with the reapers, so all the sheaves were coming out loose. They were there, the women tying them up, making a whisper straw, tying the sheaves up. In England, if the chap on the binder ran out of binder twine and left so many sheaves to have tied up by hand, the Britishers were complaining about it. But the Germans got on with it, didn't they? They seemed to make something out of nothing, you know. And they didn't give in. I remember one incident where there'd been quite a battle, and some of the infantrymen came across a German who'd been left, and his leg had gone gangrenous. Our MO, we stopped the battle to attend for our MO to go and attend to this German. The Americans would have shot him and put him out of his misery, but not us. Somebody offered him a cigarette. He wouldn't accept it. I think he thought they were going to poison him or something like, you know. All little incidents like that you remember.
Do you feel any hatred towards
them? I don't feel any hatred for them, no. In fact, I bought a German car some years, 1977 VW Polo. My eldest sister, she said, "I never thought you'd buy a German car." I said, "Well, I've got to buy the car that suits me and that's maybe a bit superior to an English car at that time," which was, I think, Ford's copied the idea. I mean, the Germans brought that type of car out, and then the Ford, they copied it with a Ford Fiesta hatchback, and now they aren't producing any at all.
Any contact with civilians in Normandy?
Not in Normandy, in Holland, yes. Mm.
Any other memories from Normandy before we leave it?
The Falaise Gap, our Captain Major Tennant by then organised a tour of the Falaise Gap, because we'd been on the right flank next to the Americans for the Pinzer movement. So we had a Sunday afternoon tour of the Falaise Gap. Oh, that was terrible to see. The Germans, you'd have thought you were in a museum where the blast had killed them digging slit trenches, and they were there with the tools in their hands, mummified, you know, and the stink, it was I've been used to smells, being brought up in farming, but the deathly smell of humans is something that you never forget. But I didn't have any contact with any civilians at all while I was in Normandy. Only the odd dead one, where hotels had been sort of shelled and gable ends of houses had been knocked out and people were in bed, you know, sort of the blast had killed them and they were still there. Cows, hundreds of cows blown up, and the shells that killed them, any animal that's not stuck, they swell up. And if there was time, we'd try and dig a hole and roll them in, you know. But oh, the stink, it was terrible at times. Washing, you didn't get, it was very dusty, you didn't get much chance. There wasn't a lot of water, but if it came a thunderstorm and there was nothing flying about, we'd strip off in our birthday so we'd have a shower with a thunderstorm, you know. Later on, when Montgomery got the mobile bath units organised, we, after several weeks in action, we'd pull out the line and take to a mobile bath unit where we'd throw our dirty clothes in, vest, pants, shirts, have a swill and shower and be issued with clean on the way out. Keep our morale up. Montgomery, he kept the morale of the forward troops up. We had mail from England within 3 days, but apart from when Operation Market Garden was on, that was when it was held up because the advance was too quick.
What happened next?
Well, we were left behind in Normandy, these heavy tanks, and actually one of my cousins who was in the East Yorkshire Regiment, he came and sorted me out after I hadn't seen him for 7 years, and we actually met. Well, after the battle was over, he'd landed on D-Day with the East Yorkshire Regiment. And so we had quite a reunion for quite a few evenings. He was quite a good water polo player, and we used to go swimming in a nearby lake. And then when they got a bridge built over the Seine, we moved on our own steam across the Bailey Bridge and were harboured up between Rouen and Beauvais. Then we were there till, well, the paratroopers dropped Arnhem, Nijmegen, and when they failed to, well, the troops to capture the bridge at Arnhem, we were put on transporters and we were transported all the way up because we couldn't drive all that way. There was very slow tanks, about 20 miles an hour, and they weren't built for long journeys on the road. So we put on tank transporters, Diamond T's. I think the unit weighed 30 tons and the tank on top was 40 tons. So you were moving a 70-ton load in convoy. I think it took us about 3 days, you know, to get up to a bridge called Grave. And some of my colleagues said, it looks like grave to me, you know. I said, well, it's spelt the same, but they pronounce it grave. And we were in the Reichswald Forest, took over from the American airborne troops, took over from them, and we were harboured up there for quite some time, about 2 weeks, I think.
Doing what?
Well, we were just sort of dug in, you know, slit trenches, and used to be a bit of shelling on a night and waiting to see if there was any advance from the Germans. I always remember that. Sergeant Major Gurney came to me one evening. He said, you know a bit about farming, Brown, don't you? I said, yeah. Well, he says, there's a field of potatoes there. He says, I'm going to detail a squad. He says, for you to dig some potatoes up, throw it and have some new fresh potatoes. There weren't new potatoes because it was September time. I said, you don't have to know anything about farming, sir, to dig potatoes up. He said, well, he said, I don't want them chasing all over the field. He said, you're in charge of them. And he said, we want enough for... We'd already got the cook wagon up, you know. They knew it was safe enough to bring Echelon 2 up. So they were going to have some new potatoes rather than... We'd been on tin foil all that time, you know, from Normandy through... So Sergeant Major Gaines, he didn't want them, you know, digging a route here and a digger. I think we were just on the borders of Germany, and because the people in Holland didn't have a lot, you know, the Germans had pretty well starved them out, you know. And then that was when we started a lot of action in Holland, all around Venray, Venlo, Overloon. The Battle of Overloon, it was, they had to put it off for 24 hours. It poured with rain. We had the 3rd British Division with us then, Infantry Division. Everybody was soaked. My co-driver at the time had changed because my original co-driver, he'd gone to drive the company commander's, squadron commander's tank. Because I'd let him drive a lot. I'd learned him to drive quite a bit. He was co-driver and front gunner, and due to casualties, he'd gone, and I got another co-driver, Frank Ibbotson. He comes from Barnsley, and we were great crib players. You know, if we were in a position where we were hull down, you know, you couldn't get out, there was too much stuff, we'd get the cards and we'd play crib. He was there, I was here, and after about an hour, we had a job to see one another. The steam coming off us with our clothes drying, you know. And they had to put the battle off for 24 hours till we got dried out. And as soon as it stopped raining, I just used to start the tank up and the exhaust. We just used to hold the clothes over the exhaust, and within a few minutes, everything was dry, you know, the terrific heat that was coming through those twin exhaust pipes.
What happened in the battle at Overloon?
Well, the Battle of Overloon, it's quite a famous battle. And there's actually a museum. It's an open-air museum at Overloon. Anybody visiting Holland, it's worth a visit. It's all block-paved, the route all the way around. And there's one of our tanks more or less in the position where it got mined and knocked out. And we actually... We beat the Germans there, and it's one of our famous battles.
What happened to you in the battle?
What happened to me? Well, I managed to survive it. you know, I had this 95mm howitzer, and I used to give, I didn't, but the gunner did, used to give close support to any infantry. If they wanted smoke, we could put smoke down, close smoke, so they could advance and we could also put HE high explosive shells over as well, you know, giving the infantry support.
Where exactly were you in the battle?
Well, it was quite an extensive area, but Overloon was the main town, you know, a small town.
Could you see the Germans?
Oh, yes, you saw Germans, live and dead.
But you weren't hit?
No, the only thing I had, I had the stowage bins blown off the tank, which were maybe blown off by shells. Not completely blown off, but badly damaged. I've got a piece of shrapnel that was lodged in my greatcoat, because my greatcoat was stored in the stowage bins. You didn't have a lot of stowage area in them. In the tank, you didn't clutter the tank up too much. You had to make sure that you had an escape route. If you got hit and the tank got on fire, you had a pannier door on each side for the co-driver and the driver and the co-driver. because if the turret was traversed at a certain angle, you couldn't get the hatch open at the top. So you kept these panniers and the area to them clear of anything, so if you got hit and the tank went on fire, you bailed out where the three in the turret, they could get out through the cupola at the top, you see.
What happened next?
Well, after the battle was over, we were still attacking places in Holland, and one incident I do remember very vividly, as if it was today. We were attacking to take a place called Liesel, and it was a misty morning, similar to what we've had this week in England. And Major Bridge, who was now the squadron commander, he was about 10 yards in front of me over my tank, and he opened out on this farm buildings. Well, we didn't have flashless ammunition, and the Germans, who had an anti-tank gun base, which we didn't, well, I suppose he maybe knew, but I didn't know, ranged on his flash. The Germans were pretty clever. They ranged their gun on his flash. We heard these shells falling around us. I was about 20 yards behind Major Bridges' tank. Then all of a sudden, we saw his tank go up in flames. They'd ranged on him and then they'd put an armour-piercing shell. And it had gone into the front, killed a co-driver. The tank set on fire. The wireless operator, Sergeant Kenneth Pears, who'd been slept in the same hut as me all those years from training, he was in charge of all our signalling in the squadron. He didn't get out. He was cremated. Guardsman Neil, the co-driver, was cremated. The driver, who'd been my co-driver, he dived out head first. But the Major Bridge and Sergeant Cartwright, they were rolling in the dirt to put the flames out of the clothes. Well, my wireless operator, as I said, he was pretty cute. He says, let's get out of this, Brownie, so I'll put some smoke down. So he put a smoke signal in the Vary pistol, a smoke bomb, and it dropped in front of me, and there was a big privet hedge, and I put the tank in the reverse, and I got behind this privet hedge, out of cover of view, so we weren't going to be the next one. Since I've visited that actual field, and I've spoke to the grandson of the farm, and the tank is buried in that field. There was a big hole dug, and the tank tipped over into that field. Now, Sergeant Pears, he was from Nottingham. The day I got the mail to say my mother had died, been buried, and I stuck a mail from all relatives due to the hold-up for the Operation Market Garden, Kenneth Pears had got a letter to say that his first child had been born. He was killed a month after. Never lived to see that child. Guardsman Neil, his father had been an officer in the Indian Army. Lovely lad. Couldn't wish to meet a better chap. He was cremated. There was nothing left. The petrol was still there. It was all ammunition that just flared up. And this was the big fear, you see, with tanks. We used to, any broken down tanks, if we had the time, we'd get the track links off and weld them on, the spaced armour, you know, to try and avoid the 88mm armour piercing, shell piercing the tank. There was no armament good enough. We had to rely on RAF Typhoons to rocket the German tanks if they were holding us up.